Hello.
Hello, we just had lunch.
We did. Would you say it was good?
Yes, it was a bean salad. The thing is, though, I take this bean salad with me everywhere, and it's in a Tupperware, but it has a lot of onions in it, and I fear that it makes my breath smell gross.
Well, thank God I'm, like, across a table from you, so I'm not getting any whiffs of your disgusting onion breath.
I mean, you're drinking coffee, so it's basically the same thing.
Maya also had a scone.
I did, and I had it with Kerrygold butter. Do you want to tell the listeners what Kerrygold butter is?
Yeah, Kerrygold butter is Irish grass-fed butter that is truly my favorite thing in the world. Like, it's actually, like, if you were to make a starter pack of me, it would have to be there. It's such a treat.
It's like she's asking us to make a starter pack of her. You actually made one of me when we were both living in Montreal.
Yeah, when we were, like, little babies.
What was on it again?
It was canned sangria.
Hoop earrings.
Probably, yeah. Oh, I don't know what else. I'm sure it was hilarious.
If we were to make a starter pack of each other now, what would it be? I would put on yours Kerrygold butter, a really, really big red backpack.
Rude.
Cassandra carries around this backpack that's so big.
Oh my God.
It makes her look so silly.
I haven't in years.
I used to like straight up bully her when we were going to the same university for a little bit, and she
made fun of me, and now I'm scarred and I don't ever use my backpack. She made me feel like such a loser.
Good friends roast each other. Knitting supplies.
Aww.
A cup of lukewarm coffee with like two supremely melted ice cubes in it.
Okay.
And like a prairie dress or some like 70s style like patchwork pants.
Yeah, that's
oh,
fair.
And either Sofia Coppola, like a still from The Virgin Suicides or from Lady Bird.
Okay, roast me.
I love that about you. Oh, and like Fleetwood Mac me.
Yeah, okay. For you, I would put Mooney. I would put peanut M&Ms, a Mooby tote. Sponsor me, movie.
She plugs Kerrygold butter, I plug movies.
a little Labo starter pack.
Oh, yeah.
Or wait, a little
discovery
Labo
pack.
Discovery pack.
I smell like every bitch in North America. I saw my friend yesterday and I was like, you're wearing Santel. She was like, you got me.
And a Yankees cap, but that's like really in good condition because you never wear it. But you always think about wearing it.
I have to like really think about it before I wear a cap outside, and I don't know why. Like, it feels political.
To wear a Yankees cap.
I'm Maya.
I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the social media phenomenons that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is all about internet archetypes and the many, many lives they've lived. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have monthly bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that would be doing us a solid. Today's episode is going to be more serious in tone. We're discussing some pretty heavy subject matter, specifically the sexual and psychological abuse of minors. If this is something that's particularly difficult for you, we advise listening with caution. If you need to skip this one, we understand. And with that, today we are discussing groomers. I'm sure a lot of you have seen this word pop up in most facets of the online world and have looked it up at some point in the past few years. But I want to look at where the term grooming came from, how it plays out in our legal system, and what it's evolved into today. I think out of all the archetypes we've discussed so far this season, which have all been abstracted from their original meaning to some degree or another, the dilution of groomer has by far the most harmful real-life consequences. But we'll get to that in a bit. Hannah, what is your understanding of the term grooming?
My understanding is an adult, typically somebody in a position of power, although I guess age gaps sort of create those anyways, who establishes a closer than typical relationship with a younger person for the intention of like exploiting that power imbalance, I suppose. I guess it's mostly just like romantic and sexual. Is there like platonic grooming?
Well, that'll be a huge debate in this episode.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's pretty on the nose. I think you're getting to what people largely understand grooming as today. I do think that there's an aspect of it, which we'll talk about, that doesn't get hashed out enough in discussions. So we'll hash it out.
Famously. We'll rehash it.
So I just wanted to give like a little bit of historical context for the word. So the term actually originated from a behavior observed in social psychology called social grooming, based on a very literal practice observed in primates, where they would like literally groom and clean each other. Social grooming is a process by which social creatures groom each other in exchange for like all sorts of social benefits, one of those being an interchange of favors. And then the study of social grooming extended into human behavior, where social grooming evolves into forms of like flattery. So studies of kindergartners have shown that, quote, preschoolers have already learned not to articulate bluntly their true feelings and thoughts about others. Rather, they are able to manipulate their communications according to social context. Are there times that you found yourself social grooming in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are like, it's just sort of like your tactic of getting things that you want without being outright about it, right?
Yeah, and I think it can be kind of like, in the context of social grooming, like unconscious and conscious, I think it's something that literally everyone does all the time. It's like a very natural aspect of human behavior.
I think it's probably like, I'm thinking middle school, wanting to befriend like popular girls and, you know, talking to them in a more planned out or thoughtful way to try and like ingratiate yourself to them.
Definitely. I think if you were to look at middle school, it would be a huge microcosm for just like basic human behaviors.
Yeah, you watch like Pen 15 and the way they talk to like the popular girls, you're like, yeah. You just kind of like gassing them up a bit so they'll like you.
Exactly. Yeah, when I think of it, I'm like, these are probably more overt examples, but I'm thinking of like flirting with men to buy you drinks, too, or like giving gifts to your teacher at Christmas and hoping that they like you more so they can give you grades in the future that are better than the ones you're getting.
Okay.
To me, at least. I think it can also be more subtle by way of just complimenting, like you're saying, with like the popular girls. Again, yeah, acting in a certain way to, you know, achieve clout, for example. Like you see people changing when they're in situations where they feel like other people have more social capital than them.
Yeah, so social climbing.
Kind of like social climbing, yeah. But these are like pretty obvious examples. I think it happens way more commonly on a daily basis. I don't think it necessarily has to mean you're trying to ascend society. But those are, yeah, again, the things I could think of. I mean, I don't think you necessarily have to be bribing people either. But right. Those are just like obvious examples. So naturally, social grooming, which, you know, is this kind of subtle form of social flattery, where the flatterer expects favors in return some of the time, evolves into sexual grooming.
Okay.
So from what I can find, although it's kind of unclear because its origins are kind of varied, the term sexual grooming has been attributed to a former FBI agent named Ken Lanning, who specialized in cases of child sexual exploitation. Lanning has done quite a few talks about this phenomenon over the years, and a study that I read about like the term's origins, who attribute Lanning to the word, say that Lanning's main takeaway is that, quote, the term of grooming has mainly helped explain the impact on victims, and in particular, the compliance of the victim with the offender. But he also believes, quote, that the emphasis on seduced or groomed is less important than the nature and development of the relationship between the abused and the abuser. This is going to become important later. So I think it's important we cover an official definition of grooming before we proceed with the episode. So, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, also known as RAIN, defines grooming as such. Manipulative behaviors that the abuser uses to gain access to a potential victim, coerce them to agree to the abuse, and reduce the risk of being caught. While these tactics are used most often against younger kids, teens and vulnerable adults are also at risk. And then they list out five distinct ways in which this process gets conducted. One, victim selection, where an abuser will select a victim based on ease of access and perceived vulnerability. Two, gaining access and isolating the victim, so an abuser makes sure to separate the victim from people who can protect them. Three, trust development and keeping secrets, where an abuser will provide gifts and special attention to the victim and share secrets with them as a means of training them to withhold from others. Four, desensitization to touch and discussions of sexual topics. So an abuser gradually breaks down the victim's physical boundaries by starting off with, quote, harmless touching and working their way up from there. They may also talk about sex explicitly with the victim and show them pornography. And then lastly, five, attempt by abusers to make their behavior seem natural, which all of the aforementioned strategies contribute to. And then I found just another definition from the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Sex Offender Sentencing, Monitoring, Apprehending, Registering, and Tracking, also known as SMART. There's a lot of acronyms here. They define it as a method used by offenders that involves building trust with a child and the adults around a child in an effort to gain access to and time alone with them. In extreme cases, offenders may use threats and physical force to sexually assault or abuse a child. More common, though, are subtle approaches designed to build relationships with families. Are you seeing any kind of like themes or patterns crop up in those two definitions?
The idea of like somebody warming their way into another person's life. Grooming isn't when some random person like commits like a horrible act, like assault. It's somebody who's like established some kind of a relationship, some kind of trust with victims. And then, yeah, I guess also with the people around those victims a lot of the time. It's about almost like making it mundane.
Totally. I think it's about, you know, breaking down barriers little by little so yeah. that people don't even notice that the barriers have been broken down by the time it's too late.
The slow process.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I had kind of noticed. I think it's basically defined by its covertness. In the same way that social grooming is, it's supposed to be like a subtle effort to normalize the behavior. So, you know, like there's a San Francisco case from 2009 called Light v. Martel that the American Bar Association uses in their article on grooming, which is kind of a landmark case. And I think it really shows what was going on. So like in the case, the defendant Light was charged with child sexual abuse. And during the trial, the prosecution testified that Light had been giving the victims sweets, showing them cartoons and engaging in like consistent contact with them. So he was like kind of close to them and he felt familiar. And this was an early case where expert testimony was admitted on patterns of grooming by showing how Light like ingratiated himself, like you said, to the victims in ways that may seem innocent to the untrained eye. And now this kind of testimony is important for understanding like how child molesters operate more generally.
Yeah.
Do you know of any famous examples in real life or in the media where grooming by this definition takes place, this kind of like very classical understanding of it?
I mean, I feel like the R. Kelly and Aaliyah case, which I'll be honest, like I don't know a lot of the details on, so I'm not going to like talk about it as if I do. But he had a relationship with her like as a producer, as someone that she was working with. There was them spending a lot of time together, right? Was like innate within their relationship.
Yeah, I think he had established this dynamic of trust. Like, I mean, she's not here to talk about it, right?
Yeah, of course.
But just from the outside looking in and based on his later patterns of behavior, it's pretty clear that R. Kelly does prey upon underage people. And so it's pretty obvious what was going on there. And like, yeah, breaking down these barriers of trust, but also being in this kind of like paternal position with her where she felt like she had to trust him and she was indebted because he was like helping her career.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they later got married.
Or even just like, you know, again, I did not watch the documentaries because I just was like, this is too much for me. But the Michael Jackson cases, right? Like the families were also brought into his world. It wasn't like the kids were.
Mm-hmm. It's like establishing a culture of trust that allows more inappropriate dynamics to go unnoticed.
Yeah, exactly.
Or just accept it. Like the most conventional example I can think of, which is pretty similar to what you just brought up, would be from that Netflix documentary Abducted in Plain Sight. Have you seen it?
I haven't.
Basically, it's a documentary where a 12-year-old named Jan Broberg was abducted by her adult neighbor in the 70s, not once, but twice. And to answer the main question of how this could happen, we could look to grooming. Like the neighbor established this pattern of trust and isolation, not only with Jan, but with her parents, which allowed her to be abused in plain sight. So it allowed the situation where he could come in and out of the family. And even though he had already abducted her once, they were so forgiving of him and trusted him so much that he was able to be welcomed back into their family,
right?
And then do it again.
Yeah.
And it's taken like years for them to kind of fully assess the situation and be like, that wasn't okay, which obviously to the outside public was like, what are you thinking, what are you doing, how can you allow this man back in? But it's like this psychological manipulation.
Well, the whole point is that you like you blur boundaries enough that like you can't tell when you've crossed them,
when your boundaries are being trespassed upon. Exactly. Yeah. I also think there's some like less conventional examples that have been really big in the media in recent years. There's a couple examples on TikTok with younger perpetrators, which has contributed a bit to like expanding and understanding our definition of the word, particularly with these two creators, Zoe Laverne and Tony Lopez. Zoe, who was 19 at the time, established an inappropriate relationship with a 13-year-old fan. She like kissed him on camera and the two were seen wearing Bond bracelets in their videos, which is basically this bracelet where two people can wear it, and if one person touches theirs, the other vibrates, like, remotely. People started accusing Zoe of being a groomer, and she responded very, like, flippantly. I think she took, like, an audio of someone accusing her, and she, like, made a video that was obviously very not okay and tone deaf. She also said, quote, "We both were in a dark place when we first became friends, and we both just ended up catching feelings for each other. And friends do that. They catch feelings for each other. That's not a bad thing. Yes, the age is a bad thing. Yes, it's wrong. Yes, it's not good. We both realized that, and we stopped." Like, obviously, though, there is a huge power imbalance between a very, very famous TikToker in her late teens and a pubescent boy who, like, doesn't have a following.
Yeah.
And then there were allegations that came out against Tony Lopez, who's, like, one of those, like, hype house dance boys.
Okay.
Kind of, like, early TikTok kind of guys.
Oh, God. You know, I'm, like, there are a lot of these people I just don't know who they are, even though I've been on TikTok for
so long. Hannah's TikTok is so niche. But basically, a girl alleged that she had been invited to the Hype House in 2020 and met Tony, who, according to the lawsuit, quote, "acknowledged numerous times the fact that CH Doe was a minor and would commonly tell her to stop being 16 years old, among other references to the fact that she was underage." The victim says that Tony solicited nudes from her and coerced her to perform sexual acts on him. Again, like, another case between a younger adult and a minor. Mm-hmm. Tony was 21 here, and he's been widely criticized for grooming on TikTok. Do these cases give you pause at all, like, just by the nature of the defendant's age?
I think it is more complicated than the cases we laid out just now. Yes, because the age difference, and, like, just because you've turned 18 doesn't mean, like, you were fully functioning and, like, thinking as a rational adult. So, like, being a 19-year-old and doing something like that, it's obviously
wrong.
It's wrong, and, like, there are definitely consequences that come from that, but I just don't see it the same way as someone, like, systematically, like, abusing, like, power imbalance that comes with actually living a full life as an adult or being somebody as powerful as, like, R. Kelly or Michael Jackson and using it in that way.
I think it's, like, obviously confusing because you can see where there is very sexually inappropriate behavior happening mm-hmm. here. And, like, there is an active awareness on the part of the older person that what they're doing is wrong. And, like, they say it out loud. I don't know. It's just hard to judge what grooming is, which we'll talk about, because with these other cases, it's like this is a long established relationship before the actual abuse takes place. It's not that you meet a few times and then the abuse takes place. I mean, it's just difficult with these two cases because yeah. like Zoe Laverne and this boy did seem to have contact. It's hard to know whether or not grooming specifically is applicable here, regardless of whether or not the cases are sexually inappropriate.
I mean, it is a... unfortunately, a common thing that we see among celebrities of them, like, leveraging their position and, like, their fame, you know, with fans or with people who look up to them in order to take advantage of them.
To gain access to them, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't have really an answer as to whether or not I think either of those cases is necessarily grooming, because, like, there are aspects of them that make me be like, yeah, I do see a pattern of trust being established here. But then also, because of how young the defendants are, it's hard to be like, how much of the age gap is being abused? It's just difficult.
It's certainly wrong. And I think in both cases, illegal.
Yeah, California doesn't have Romeo and Juliet laws, which I know Tony Lopez's case took place there. So it is illegal.
Yeah.
Based on that core theme we talked about, like the covertness of the act, are there any problems you could imagine that would come up when you're trying to litigate or criminalize this?
I think it's really hard to pinpoint, like, somebody's motivations if there's not, like, an actual outcome that comes from the grooming, right? Because part of a conviction, I mean, for a lot of crimes, it's necessary to have a mens rea and an actus reus. I know, like, attempted murder and stuff is a crime, and I'm sure, like, there are ways that you can be convicted for things that you didn't do but tried to do. But I would say, unless there is, like, actual evidence of a crime being committed, I mean, it's already so hard to, like, prosecute so many sex crimes that I really can't imagine that you could prosecute somebody for maybe seeming like they were planning on committing a sex crime. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I think you're kind of nailing it on the head. The article about Landing that I was reading says something really interesting. They talk about how abusers intentionally use grooming as a means of silencing a victim, right? Most often a child. But then they say, of course, somehow the silence was broken for the child to be seen at the hospital, and thus we wrote on patterns of disclosure most often delayed. And what got me here was that the silence was broken, in most cases, in the hospital. meaning that the abuse had already happened.
Yeah.
So here's the problem, which I think you kind of articulated. There are two types of laws that directly or indirectly combat grooming in the States. We're going to focus on the States just because that's where the majority of our listeners are from, and that's where most of the cases that we've talked about are from, yeah. just for the sake of specificity. The more indirect laws would be against, like, internet luring and child pornography, which are kind of a given, right? Internet luring is kind of an act of grooming because you're trying to coerce an underage person to trust you enough that they would establish a relationship with you and, like, meet you in real life, for example.
So you're saying there are laws against that?
Against internet luring, yes. Okay. And there are obviously laws against child pornography, which yeah. we know. And then the more direct one, it's section 2422B of the U.S. Criminal Code, which is called coercion and enticement. And it, quote, prohibits anyone from knowingly persuading, inducing, enticing, or coercing an individual to travel in interstate or foreign commerce with the purpose of engaging in prostitution or any criminal sexual activity. So in this case, it would be the abuse of a minor. Or attempting to do so. And imposes a maximum punishment of 10 years imprisonment and or a fine under Title 18. And the penalty is 15 years if it's an underage person. That's the victim. The American Bar Association commented on this law. They said, to prove a violation of Section 2422B of the code, a prosecutor must show that an offender intended to complete the crime and took a substantial step toward its completion. With regard to intent, the government must prove that the defendant intended to cause assent on the part of the minor, not that he acted with a specific intent to engage in sexual activity. Although the term substantial step can be an elusive concept, it is described as more than mere preparation, but less than the act before the crime is committed.
So this law is about the intention of, like, kidnapping, basically?
It's all about the enticing, inducing, and coercing. So it can be to entice them to travel, mm-hmm. like, between states or outside of the country.
Yeah.
With the intention of prostituting that person or doing any sort of criminal activity with them or attempting to do so. So it's like the law is about taking that person out of the state. It talks about more like the process of doing that.
Right.
So again, like, there isn't really any law that is explicitly, like, criminalizing grooming behavior. But we talk about it a lot in public discourse because it is something that you want to look out for. But you can't actually, like, seek any retribution for it unless sexual abuse has already occurred, in which case you would just be seeking retribution for the abuse, not for the grooming.
Yes.
So, like, the biggest issue is that grooming in its true form must be done with the explicit intent of sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But grooming itself is a process leading up to the abuse, right?
Right, yeah.
Which makes it very difficult to litigate or discern in, like, real time, because the process needs to have already happened and the abuse to have already occurred to properly identify the intent, right?
Yes, of course.
And so, like, how do you prove a substantial step if the intent of the step is to make it look normal to the yeah. people around you?
That's why so many crimes require that you've, like, actually committed an act, because people can have all sorts of crazy ideas in their head, but if they're not, like, actually implementing harm, and then yeah, if the potential crime is one that is just, like, so based in, like, normalizing behaviors, then, like, you're not really going to pinpoint any exact moment where it's cross over the line. And even still, when it comes to, like, sexual assault, that is a hard thing to prosecute because of lack of evidence.
Exactly. So if you're trying to prosecute someone attempting to coerce someone into something, what is the evidence going to be if not sexual abuse, which is already another crime in and of itself? I know you have a lot of thoughts about the way vaguely defined sex crimes play out in North American culture and, like, within our justice system. Do you want to, you know, speak a bit to that?
Okay. Sex crimes are complicated, right? Because they are, on the one hand, hard to prosecute, right? And there is a lot of dissatisfaction that comes out of the legal process. But then also, people who are convicted of sex crimes, and it's a wide spectrum of things that qualify as sex crimes a lot of the time, are basically, I guess, I don't know fully how it works in the States. I don't know if it depends on the state or depends on the law, but I think people are disproportionately...
We apply this, like, unilateral registry to a very wide spectrum of sex crimes where, like, anyone can end up on the sex offender registry regardless of what the actual crime was.
And it sort of contradicts the idea of, like, you know, do the crime, do the time, and then, you know, you've paid your dues and you move on. Because when it comes to the sex registry, for however long you're on there, and
I think it might be lifelong for a lot of states.
So then there you go. That, to me, just feels like an apparent, like, infringement on people's
human rights.
right? And
it's not a popular opinion. I'm sure many people won't agree, but it's true.
Yes, I understand the purpose of the sex offender registry. I understand its importance in some cases. But what really changed my mind about it was there's this podcast called In the Dark, and it's the story of this boy, Jacob Wetterling, who had been kidnapped and murdered, I think in the 80s or the 90s, like during the Stranger Danger or like the milk carton kids time. And his mom had been one of the biggest advocates for the sex offender registry and for like for harshening laws against people who commit these kinds of crimes against children. And then she, I can't remember what happened, but she changed her mind, and she's like since gone back spoken about like the harm that those laws have caused. Because the thing about the sex offender registry is like once you're on it, it's very, very difficult to live a normal life,
to change. It doesn't allow you to change.
Well, because it kind of makes it impossible to reintegrate yourself back into society, especially if you're there for a lifetime, right? Housing is hard to find, employment is hard to find, and the more dire the circumstances we push people into, I think the more likely they are to
reoffend.
And I personally, just from what I've learned in criminology, I personally feel that harsh penalties as a form of deterrence is like not an effective way of preventing recidivism. And so for me, it just seems like punishment for punishment's sake, because obviously in a lot of those cases, you know, the crimes are pretty horrible, and I understand the anger with them and like why we
it's
would,
an emotional it's like a deeply emotional subject.
Yes, but I think that ultimately if what we're trying to do is fix a problem systemically, like that is not the way to go about it. But it's hard to strike a balance between like people seeking justice and then what is ultimately just like, yeah, lifelong punishment for crimes that don't actually say they have life sentences, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think like with Me Too, we did a good job of expanding our understanding of how pervasive sexual violence can be, but this has also snowballed into believing that certain forms of sexual violence, like sex trafficking, are so covert and so pervasive that we start seeing them everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And even in places that they might not be, right? Which results in kind of like an overinflation of statistics that we simply like don't have. We can't access statistics about something that is meant to be covert in the first place. Also like an undue targeting of like sex workers and other marginalized people as a result of that.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, when it comes to like human trafficking laws, the people that are hurt most of the time are sex workers. Obviously human trafficking does happen in some form in the United States, but oftentimes the statistics and like information that is passed around about it can often be like overly conflated. Yeah. In a lot of ways. And then by targeting that specific issue, it puts a lot of people who work in the sex industry at harm, the people that are probably at much more of a risk for violence, for danger, and then for
criminalization,
yeah, in harm's way. For example, the laws that have been passed to take down like online spaces where sex workers can advertise and get in contact with customers has all been done like for the sake of whatever, reducing like human trafficking. That's what people are pushing for. But what it really does is like make it like a really, really unsafe place for people who do work in sex work to do their business. And it leads people to like have to find much more underground, much less regulated avenues for finding that work, because getting rid of places like Backpage, which was a big website used by sex workers, doesn't make people stop being sex workers. It just puts them in a position where they have to find their work elsewhere.
And so it ends up having kind of real life effects to the people who actually have nothing to do with the actual problem.
Well, yeah. And I would also just say, like, obviously the idea of someone experiencing human trafficking is horrible. That pain is terrible. But getting rid of spaces that are primarily used by sex workers, not human trafficking victims, isn't going to diminish the harm caused by human trafficking. That's not going to like get rid of human trafficking as an industry in whatever realms that it exists in the United States. It is just criminalizing and further marginalizing people who work in the sex industry.
Yeah, and like with regards to grooming, the American Bar Association features a warning that while the coercion and enticement statute is, quote, well-intentioned and focuses on the protection of children, such laws have traditionally faced various challenges alleging unequal treatment and overly harsh punishments, which is what you were just getting at. So like ultimately grooming exists in a legal gray area. There's a psychologist, David Lay, who is pretty critical about the way grooming has evolved as a word in our culture. He talks about how difficult it is to prosecute, and then he kind of concludes that the term grooming is best seen as a colloquial term used by laypersons to describe complex phenomena and behavior patterns, where researchers and clinicians apply nuance and specificity to distinguish and identify behaviors of individuals involved in sexual offending.
It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
The problem is, though, that the use of grooming in the colloquial sense also kind of has its downsides. Are there ways that you could see that happening?
If people are trying to move things in a direction where we are criminalizing things that like may or may not constitute as grooming, it becomes scary because, yeah, I think in our popular culture, we have started to use the word grooming very freely as
liberally, yeah.
Yeah, as happens with buzzwords.
Every word in this season.
Yeah, and I think especially when we talk about instances in popular culture where we're not actually privy to like the interpersonal relationships of the people involved, it feels like kind of murky territory. I mean, overall, it's just like it's really hard to have an informed opinion on relationships between famous people that we actually don't know like the nuances or the ins and outs of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's hard because it's like I also do think a lot of the cases, like I'm thinking about Drake and Millie Bobby Brown, right?
Mm-hmm.
When she kind of told this cute anecdote to her, cute anecdote about how Drake and her texted and she was like 13.
And they go to dinner together, yeah.
And he was like giving her dating advice. Like people were immediately like, this is whack. This is, you know, grooming, people were saying. And Drake was dating a girl. I don't know if they're still dating, but he was dating a girl that he had known since she was like 16. And then they publicly came out as dating when she was like 18 or something.
Yeah.
So like, I by no means think that Drake is like above what people were accusing him of. I mean, famous men have these patterns of behavior when it comes to younger girls.
And women, I guess, with Aaron Taylor Johnson and Sam Taylor Wood.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's like a gray area in the way we talk about grooming.
Yes.
And, you know, like there's this Broadway star named Alice Ripley who was accused of grooming by 5 people on TikTok, all of whom alleged that Ripley had formed intense and inappropriate relationships with them. They were also fans of hers and they were minors and were queer. And it was kind of like this like little cult of young fans who she'd like pit against each other and manipulate psychologically by making them feel special and then dropping them on a dime. Although one alleges that Ripley kissed them in her dressing room, for the most part, none of them accused Ripley of sexual abuse. But the initial person to come out about it, Brie Lynn, alleged in a viral video on TikTok that Ripley would say to them when they were just 12 that when they locked eyes, the world stopped. They also said that Ripley would send them risque photos of herself. Lynn also says that when they brought up sexual conversations to Ripley, she like wouldn't shut them down. So this is one of those difficult situations because grooming, like while it's being defined as a process, not an outcome, is done with the express intent of sexually abusing a victim, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard with the case of Alice Ripley or even Drake with Millie Bobby Brown, right?
Yeah.
Because Ripley didn't necessarily sexually abuse them, but she basically allegedly, you know, conducted a psychologically manipulative process that did end up harming the minors that she was interacting with. Like many of them said that they had to seek therapy after they lost contact with her. And so it does feel like one instance where we're kind of opening up the definition by an inch to fit these more gray scenarios where people are harmed in one way or another.
Well, yeah, and even with like Drake and Millie Bobby Brown, it's like not like Millie Bobby Brown has come out and said anything, although like that doesn't mean that nothing could have happened. All we know is that they had a friendship that, yeah, a man of his age shouldn't have with a girl of her age, but we just aren't privy to like what's going on in the time between them. I don't know. Sometimes it just feels weird to like kind of project then that label onto that scenario when like we're basically speaking on her behalf.
Yeah, with her especially. Like, I think these people with Ripley are saying that Ripley groomed them, but with Millie, yeah, it's different. Do you find, like, at least in the case of Ripley, that expanding the term's definition has had certain benefits to it?
Yeah, I mean, like, if somebody is abusing their power in their relationship with, like, another person, I think especially if they are, like, a public-facing figure, I think that there's benefit to calling it out because, I mean, then, you know, we're always getting these stories about stuff that happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago about this, like, very famous, powerful figure who was doing it under the radar and like caused harm to a lot of people. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to call these things out before more harm is able to be conducted. It's just, it's always murky when we are accusing strangers of crimes.
I know it's confusing because like the Ripley case in particular, you know, I do think it was helpful for the victims to use this language because the actual manipulation process was being prioritized, at least in the conversation around it. Mm-hmm. Like, why does the act of sexual abuse have to occur and someone to be, like, harmed in that way just to be able to talk about the process or which happened? Like, I think with Me Too, you know, we're trying to expand these concepts of psychological abuse is also a major thing at play here. And, like, grooming itself has consequences beyond the sexual abuse. It can be extremely damaging and, like, very confusing for the victim. Even for us growing up, and I think many, many, many young women would relate to it. As a teenager, I felt like I was often exposed to older men who were very comfortable being around me, like guys in their 20s. And, you know, more women I talk to have had that experience. Like, one of my friends was in a film with this guy who I think was like 25 at the time, and he invited us to his Halloween party. And like at that age, you just are not thinking about how that is weird. Like, you are not considering the age gap at all. You don't understand.
No.
And so you don't have the mental or emotional toolkit to understand that. So like we went to his party and thinking about it now, it's like we're a bunch of 15-year-olds standing in our little dorky like homemade Halloween costumes in a room full of 25-year-olds. And at our age now, like we are that age. If I ever went into a party and saw a bunch of 15-year-olds standing there, I would be like, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is not okay. But it was so normal back then because we didn't have this language to talk about what was going on. I don't think he was grooming us, but, you know, there was a very inappropriate age gap.
Yeah. I never had an experience like that per se. I worked in a part-time job where I was around a lot of grown men. I had very, like, I had close relationships with my male coworkers who were, like, 5-6 years older than me, maybe. And it was never, like, a boundary crossing thing at all with them. Like, it was very much
sexual boundaries.
Or, yeah, it was, like, brother and sister with me and these guys that I worked with. But it's also, like, even though I really don't think that this was, like, kind of the situation at all, if you were to put like the bird's eye view look at it the way that people do with like these stories online, you'd be like, well, why are these guys in their early 20s so chummy with teenage girls? But we didn't hang out outside of work. Like the boundaries were very clear, but it was like I got in a fight with one of them once and he bought me like he gave me a Christmas gift and it was like a nice gift. I think it was more just because he was like, he made me really mad and was like trying to just like placate me because I was in like more of a brotherly way. But I don't know. It's hard because like I those were like really meaningful relationships to me. And then I've also like definitely worked with men older than that definitely said things to teenage girls that they should not have said to teenage girls.
Yeah.
And regardless of like what their actual intentions were, made a very uncomfortable environment for me. Those were not people I had close relationships with, but people that definitely abused those positions of power to get away with
pushing the boundaries, testing like the limits,
verbally at least. But also like at that age, even though now I'm looking back at it and I'm like, yeah, ew, that was wrong no, like, why would you say any of those things to, like, an underage girl? At the time, I wanted to be an adult. I wanted to be treated as one. And I, you know, I hung out with teenage boys who said, like, gross stuff sometimes, or, like, I heard teenage boys say gross things. So the difference of it coming from, like, men in their 30s wasn't really, like, hitting the same way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think Tavi Gevinson wrote this piece kind of responding to, like, the Free Britney movement, and just, like, the ways that people were really trying to push this idea. We talked about this in a different episode, but push this idea that she was, like, fully in control of the way she was being portrayed sexually. And Tavi was kind of pushing back and, like, talking about, you know, the experience of, I think, like, being, like, a precocious teenager and really being treated like an adult in some ways and wanting to be seen and treated as an adult. And so allowing behavior from older men to feel more normal to you, because in your mind, like, if you're going to be an adult, you then you can, like, deal with adult things.
Well, it's also just like, this is going to sound like the stupidest thing on earth, but at that age, like, you are the oldest you have ever been.
Yeah.
So it is like you are at the limit of your maturity in that very moment. So you think you are so much more mature than you actually are because you don't know what it's like to be more mature than that. Everything seems normal to you because that's all you know. You don't know anymore. If only in hindsight and with, like, wisdom and age can you look back and say that that's weird. And I do think that since those instances of being, like, since we were teenagers, I do think the culture has, like, shifted and evolved, I hope, to be. And, like, I do think that the, like, you know, discourse around grooming is helpful in that way. I think even with the Alice Ripley case, I do think it's gray, but I think that that helped at least provoke a wider conversation about the process of grooming more generally, even, like, the Drake and Millie Bobby Brown stuff.
Oh, totally. And I would hope that, like, you know, a 2023 version of myself, like, the girls out there who are, you know, trying to deal with, you know, inappropriate comments and stuff, but think that maybe they're overreacting, maybe now have, like, the kind of perspective or, like, knowledge to be more sure that what they're experiencing is
wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think there's a way that this kind of colloquial gray area can play out in a way that I think is negative. In this Rolling Stone article about Ripley, they interview a children's psychologist named Brandy Lyles, amazing name, who says, if one person is older than the other, they have more experiences and knowledge. If they're using that experience and knowledge to control and coerce the person into sexual activities and other behaviors, I would consider grooming to be present. But again, like, that age gap thing can be a bit vague. And I think recently we've taken the idea of, like, if one person is older than the other, and we've kind of run with it.
Well, we do apply it to, like, two full-grown adults sometimes now, where it's like, yeah, I'm sure that there's always complications that come with having, like, a sizable age gap between two people in a relationship.
We just had a scandal in Toronto where our mayor, John Tory, had an affair with one of his employees, and he stepped down for that, not because he was a fucking horrible mayor who is running the city into the ground and has done so many things that are bad for us, but because of this affair. And everyone who has been talking about it has basically been characterizing it as, like, a non-consensual age gap grooming situation where he used his power to coerce this woman. She was, like, in her 30s.
Yeah, there's obviously there's the power imbalance that comes with him being the literal mayor and her being an employee, but, like, I don't think that that's an age thing. I think that's, like, much more of, like, a don't sleep with your employees thing.
But it's also, like, okay, but she's also an adult who, I'm sorry, I just think it's very infantilizing the way people talk about women in these situations. Like, she is also still a full-grown woman. I wouldn't necessarily characterize her as, like, a vulnerable adult. Even just with the Try Guys episode, we were talking about that, right? Like, of course, yeah, you shouldn't sleep with your employees, that sucks, but it's also, like, I don't think that that necessarily means every single time across the board that it's a non-consensual affair. Like, I think that we're really taking a lot of agency away from these adult women. Sure. Like, sometimes maybe they were having an affair, and a lot of these affairs were long-term, you know, and both of them were operating clandestinely to do it, but, like, both agreed to do that. I don't think necessarily, I just don't think you can conflate those things with grooming.
Yeah, I feel similarly. Like, these are just two different issues. It's always sketchy, but, like, men in positions, in high bar positions, always have affairs with women that are subordinate to them. Like, it's so common. It's not the same as grooming, no.
I think it just comes down to, like, the dilution of terms that specifically relate to sexual abuse is kind of a delicate one because, like, on the one hand, it does provide a more normalized language with which to speak about you know, a very wide spectrum of sexual violence, but it also muddies the waters of that spectrum and attributes like pretty similar social punishments for all of it, like regardless of context or actual harm caused, you know, and this can result in across the board legal punishments as well, which can obviously also be damaging, like we talked about.
Yeah, of course.
So remember how we talked about the way that criminalizing these kinds of things ends up, you know, disproportionately targeting marginalized people?
Mm-hmm.
Well, our colloquial usage of the term has also done that. The far right has recently co-opted the term groomer to campaign against the civil rights of marginalized people.
Yeah.
The first instance is with sex workers. There was this viral TikTok going around where someone said, quote, "The real pedophiles on this app are the women who hype up and groom young girls into sex work, OnlyFans, stripping, and posting softcore porn." So basically people have got it in their heads that, like, by way of promoting their jobs on social media, that sex workers are trying to, like, Epstein-style recruit young girls into falling into the sex work industry.
When did we decide that TikTok was an app for children is all I'm going
to
say.
I think it used to be, like, majority kids on it, but then when the pandemic happened, the majority of people on there are adults.
Well, make a TikTok kids is all I'm going to say, because actually, like, people are allowed to talk about their jobs.
Oh my god, if I could talk about this with YouTube. Like, the same thing with YouTube. YouTube has a YouTube kids, yet their policies on what you can and can't say in adult YouTube is insane, just because they're worried that kids are gonna see it. And it's just like, why do we have to cater our entire world to basically speaking to children, when it's like children have their own media to watch and to listen to? Yeah. Like, it's just insane. Disney also got caught up in this insane culture war, where Disney had opposed that bill in Florida where, like, in classic Floridian fashion, they were trying to ban discussions of sexual and gender orientation from elementary school curriculum. We call it the Don't Say Gay Bill. So when Disney withdrew political donations to the state, a bunch of people on the far right accused them of grooming children into becoming gay.
Right.
And then, like, all these, like, QAnon-ass far right pundits like Matt Walsh and Haya Raichik, who runs Libs of TikTok, have accused the LGBTQ community of grooming kids into being trans. This guy, Graham Linehan, who is a, quote, anti-trans activist, got banned from Twitter for starting the hashtag OKGroomer in response to trans people who opposed his hateful beliefs. I guess it's like a play on OKBoomer.
Yeah.
And this has become one of the most popular usages of the term online today.
Literally this week, Tennessee passed a bill that criminalized drag performances in public spaces or in spaces where there are minors. So it's basically being delegated to the same kind of restrictions as stripping or cabaret, because it's sexual or whatever. And they're like, it's not anti-gay, it's not like anti-LGBTQ,
it's just anti-sex.
They're like, no, it's for the children. It's like, we shouldn't be exposing our children to this type of subject matter. It's just this idea that there is, like, grooming being done by, like, having your kids see a fucking drag show.
Well, the term, like, honestly has become this new means of othering people and making them into monsters. It's a form of, like, emotional rhetoric that you can use against people, because the way people on either side of the political spectrum in America win debates is by invoking the children, right? Like,
yeah,
whatever will happen to the children. So using, like, pedophilia, which is an objectively emotional and widely hated concept, against marginalized people can rally, like, literally anyone against them, you know? And the same goes for grooming. It plays into that. Do you think it would be safe to characterize this as, like, a full-blown moral panic at this point?
I would say definitely. I mean, especially when we talk about it in regards to, like, queer people and children. Of course it's a moral panic, you know, and we're finally in this place in our culture where trans people have, like, a space and a platform to talk about their experiences, and where, you know, people who might not have learned or really discovered that they were trans until adulthood, because they weren't being shown other trans people, are now having those realizations earlier. And that's become this whole think of the children thing, where it's actually people who were never okay with trans people to begin with, but now that they have children as sort of, like, the perfect quote-unquote victim of a pro-trans culture, they get to feel like they have a foot to stand on, because whatever, like, all this panic about children transitioning too early or too easily,
And I just think that, like, yeah, the more our culture becomes, like, pro-LGBTQ, the more, you know, the right is going to try and find ways to imply that, like, it's insidious. And, yeah, the idea that you can't, like, kids can't learn about gender identity or sexual identity in school because that is not appropriate for children, where it's, like, we were learning about human anatomy and, like, pregnancy and that stuff. I don't know, like grade 5. And these are things that actually aren't like necessarily inherently sexual either.
Well, it's also scary because even with the curriculum bans, it's like now little girls who are getting their periods, you know, a bit earlier, like 4 or 5, aren't being taught about their periods because they're trying to push back. They're not going to be learning about that because they're trying to push the age of learning about sex ed and learning about your own body till later. But there are girls who are experiencing it younger. So it's like it is going to have these widespread effects. It makes me sad when people kind of use children as a weapon to spread hate because, you know, children are valued now in our world as like these virtuous beings, right? These kind of like blank canvases. And so it's so easy for everyone to rally behind them. But then when it comes to the term grooming, like this was a word meant to actually protect children. And it actually is a word that is supposed to invoke the idea of think of the kids. But instead now it's being used against children, like it actually is going to harm them because, you know, I think the right is very rhetorically powerful. And that is what they have at their disposal, is being able to wield this rhetoric and take these very like huge buzzwords and use them against other people. And you're seeing it happening now. And it's just sad because, like, I guess every other word that we've discussed, it's just kind of done a full reversal.
Well, absolutely. And then, yeah, it becomes this thing where it is hard to talk about grooming where it actually happens because you don't want it to get confused with the sort of like moral panic misuse of the word that is happening now. And it's scary. It's also, we know just from like history that when it comes to issues about children, like oftentimes those are places where like the right is able to like sort of sometimes create allyship with certain brands of feminism. And like that is also like always a dangerous possibility because I think under the name of feminism and under the intentions of like protecting children, like a lot of harm has been caused as far as bills and laws passed that, you know, with all harsher punishments disproportionately affect marginalized people.
I would say I agree. I think it's funny because we're ending the season on this episode, which is by and large our bleakest episode. This one, we're like going from talking about himbos to talking about child sex abuse, and it's truly a big jump. Yeah, I think it just ended up at the end because we're going like back and forth between yours and mine.
Yeah.
But like we don't want to end on Karen's either.
No.
What have we learned from this season?
Well, I think with a lot of the words and like archetypes that we've explored in this season, you know, a lot of them were more popular like a couple years back. But with something like this, you know, with groomers, this is presently like a popular word that is presently being used to enact harm, you know, in our culture. And I would say like there were negative implications and like harmful implications that came with a number of the words that we've discussed, or at
almost
least,
every word.
Yeah, the ideas around them. But
this one feels like it's actually going to keep taking off. And it's scary to see how far it'll go.
Yeah. And like, obviously, what we like to do is talk about things where the story has like played out for the most part. That's sort of been our approach to topics. But it is also important to talk about subject matter that is like still very much developing, because we need to kind of try and nip these things in the buds.
Nip these things in the bud?
Nip these things in the bud.
Well, yeah, I think with this season especially, but also with the last season, like the way that these words are all used rhetorically and like seeing how quickly they can escape themselves really goes to show how fast social media moves. And, you know, I think it is important to kind of slow it down and put a magnifying glass to it and be like, okay, where is this coming from? And where can we see its trajectory going? And is there a solution to stopping it, like you just said?
Sometimes we take for granted the fact that like what happens online actually can impact what happens in the real world. And so discourse and buzzwords
that is not just being seen by people in our own bubbles. We have seen like words be co-opted in ways that in this case cause like real life damage with groomers and with the kinds of legislation that's being like proposed or passed already.
Social media is important, and it's important not to overlook it or dismiss it as, you know, something frivolous, because yes, sometimes it is frivolous and, you know, it's annoying and vapid a lot of the time, but at the same time it is a reflection of our greater culture and greater patterns and where it's headed. And so I don't know, that's why we wanted to make this podcast. Not saying that we're doing crazy important work or anything, but you know, I think it's I don't know, we're just both interested in it for that reason.
Well, sometimes we are talking about himbos and sometimes we are talking about
serious subject matter. And with that, thank you so much for listening to season 2 of Rehash.
Yeah.
We hope to be coming back to you guys soon with another season as soon as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And we'll see you then. Until then, you're welcome to join our Patreon. We're going to have some fun bonus episodes up on there, which you can listen to. I think we have one about simps coming up, which is always fun. Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.